what's going on in their life. Just think about seeing a picture from a friend versus seeing a post from a friend. It's a much richer experience, so it's a key part of how we need to scale Facebook to make it a rich and engaging experience. So when we first launched Photos way back in the day, when did we launch Photos, boss, exactly? 2005. So I'm going to bring you back to 2005, like, let's put some photos on the website. In order to do that, you kind of do it the quick and dirty way. This is a way kind of I think a lot of people would do it if you're just like, I want to share some photos really quickly. There's really you know, nothing particularly novel about this first approach. It's let's take some off-the-shelf network storage, some NFS, NAS boxes. Let's take some web servers. Let's front it. We have the shared storage, so any web server can serve any photo. Have an upload tier where I can process the photos, get them onto the storage, and kind of get them identified properly, and you're off and running. And that system works, and that's how a lot of people actually serve up photos. And it's great when you're small, but it starts to break down as you start trying to scale and serve, not just store, but serve, you know, tens or hundreds or millions of photos a second. So the systems team did what we do at Facebook. They iterated. They said, all right, we've got the system. It's kind of working, but it's kind of starting to break. So what do we do? So the first set of things was a very straightforward set of optimizations, which is, first of all, not all photos are accessed at the same time or the same frequency. So you've got things like profile photos, which are accessed extremely frequently. Let's put them off into a separate caching tier and stick them in the front. Let's use CDNs to kind of offload work to our main origin. And then also just in the back end, when you're actually storing files or serving them from the origin, there's a lot of overhead associated with NFS. If you think about, I've got a file name or identifier for this file, I've got to figure out like physically where it is on the file system. There's a set of directory lookups, a set of metadata lookups that causes IOPS on the NFS box in order to find the actual physical location on disk. If you're accessing the same file multiple times, you're repeating that same thing. So built a file system or file handle cache that allows you, once you've looked up a file, to more quickly identify it. But that wasn't good enough. That still wasn't scaling and still wasn't as cost-effective as we needed. And, you know, when you're talking billions of photos and millions of photos a second, these things really, really matter. So our team went off and decided to build a third-generation solution, which was ground-up storage and serving system built specifically for photos. And it's something we call Haystack. Like most of the infrastructure stuff we do, we've blogged about this extensively and plan to open-source it in the near future. But just to give you a sense of this, this is basically a Linux box. It's a Dell box with 12 1 terabyte SATA drives on it. And what we did is we built a user-level file system access for files, photos on this box, where we can custom design the metadata for it so that we can, in basically a single operation, look up each of these files. So to say that a little bit better, we basically take 1 gigabyte files, pack all these photos into there, build an index in RAM that we can load off the log file into the RAM that gives us the offsets for each of the files in this file system, you know, at different resolutions. So if you think about accessing this across from the network conceptually, you say, here's a photo ID at the following size, where is it? We can do a lookup in RAM to figure out exactly where on disk this file is, stream that file out. As a result, you can stream files at very, very high performance, even with random access patterns, which is common for photos like this. So to give you a sense of these three different systems, you know, this is the number of IOs that you typically had to do to load a photo. As I said, the first one was very inefficient. Second one with file handle cache got you a lot better. And the third one, Haystack, gets us to 1 IO per second. We knew the system was good when we actually accidentally load tested it one day. Where we were doing some changes to the CDNs, the content delivery networks. We use Akamai and a few others. Someone accidentally changed the CDN configuration, basically disabled them for a huge set of the photos. And the amazing thing about this is it took us quite a while to figure out this was a problem because we couldn't see a huge, you know, increase in load on the Haystack boxes. They're all kind of humming along. Someone's like, did someone change something with the CDNs? Like, because we're serving all of our photos from the origin now. So it's like way more than these boxes were designed to serve, but they didn't break a sweat. So this is the kind of system, and it was built by three people over a series of months that's now storing and serving all of the photos on Facebook.com. And I think it's a good example of us kind of taking a new approach to an existing problem and building something that's extremely high, you know, price performance, commodity drives, commodity servers, and extremely high performance. So that's one kind of glimpse into some of the scalability challenges we do. I think another fun story about scalability is our usernames launch. How many of you have a Facebook username and a URL? Awesome. How many of you got it the night we launched it? Wow. All right. So this was a product launch, like many at Facebook, that was quite controversial as we talked about doing it. So we decided that, you know, kind of a lot of sites allow you to have a short name, and a lot of people have their association with Facebook as their personal identity. So it seems to make sense that instead of being facebook.com/UID, you know, blah, 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 I could actually have a nice, easy-to-read username. So this is all well and good, except when most people do this, they have 0 million users, and at the time we had about a little over 200 million users. So the big problem was, how exactly do you get 200 million users to pick a username and do this in a fair and kind of balanced manner? So pretty much every way of allocating a scarce resource was debated. Standard auctions like eBay, VCG auctions for you auction nerds out there, which give you optimal results but are confusing as hell to explain to someone what's going on. We actually user tested that one and people had no idea what they were doing. So it was like telling them that it was the fairest way to allocate wasn't going to make it any better. So we finally said, look, let's just do the simple way. Just everyone's used to like standing in line and first come, first serve. The problem with standing in line and first come, first serve is it means we're basically asking 200 million people to show up at our website at exactly the same second on one evening. You know, when that happens, most people call that something like a denial of service attack. For us, it's like a product launch. So, and you can see here what Memcache looked like on the day we launched it. So we spent a bunch of time, and this is the team in the photo here, ops and engineering all together packed into a room on a Friday night, 9 o'clock p.m. Pacific time. We decided to launch this feature. And they did a whole bunch of optimizations up front in order to make us ready for the username launch, some creative uses of Memcache to take writes to save it from the database. And then the other thing we did, because we were actually worried not just about the usernames crashing, but people were going to come to facebook.com/username, register their username, and then you knew that they were going to click on the homepage and start browsing around the site. So, you know, for any of you who operate a site out there, you kind of optimize all your traffic patterns for the peak load at any one point in time, and we're basically asking everyone to create the highest peak load we'd ever seen on our site before. So we not only built a lot of things for the username side, we built a lot of contingency plans for the main site, which is basically turning off features. So we built a bunch of knobs on the site where we could disable chat. We could take the newsfeed stories down from a default of 45 to 15. And then we had what we called the nuclear option, which was basically just putting a static picture in for your homepage in order to make sure we didn't take the whole site down. Yeah, it was just a picture of me looking angry because we don't have a fail whale. But did I say that out loud? So I'm trying to make you guys laugh. Come on. Everyone's very quiet. I don't do comedy. So the awesome thing was we didn't actually have to use any of those things. The website was humming along just fine. No one saw any issues. We had built out enough capacity, enough contingency plans, so that when we launched the usernames, and these are pretty crazy write rates when you think about building a system, you know, a couple hundred thousand writes in a couple minutes is pretty awesome. And there were no issues, except for some creative usernames. My favorite, I think, was the URL to register a username. And we put them all in the same namespace, which is both brilliant and dumb if you think about it. So like facebook.com/, and then you can have a username. So the page where you registered was /username. Makes sense, right? Some creative person within the first like minute or two registered usernames as their name to drive a tremendous amount of traffic to their profile. Thanks to having the whole team in the room, we quickly spotted that and decided that that was not an acceptable name, so had to blacklist that. Home.aspx, however. Nothing I could do to get rid of that, so, you know, good job to that person. We don't run ASP, so... That's how we launch stuff at Facebook. We kind of prepare, and then we see what happens. So I want to take you through some of the dirty bits of the Facebook architecture. You know, this is obviously a simplification, but it gives you a sense of some of the core pieces. And what I want to do is just run through each of these pieces in a little bit of detail to kind of give you a sense of some of the challenges we face. If you look at Facebook at a super, super high level, you can really break it down to, just like every website, we have to direct traffic to different parts of our clusters through our load balancers. Our main web tier is written on PHP, and that's where a lot of the action happens in terms of our application tier. Increasingly, I talked about multi-feed earlier, and I'll get into a lot of detail on that. This is one of the many services we've built to kind of handle specific domain-specific functions on the site. And then Memcache and MySQL are our data access layer. So let me take you through this. So first question I get from a lot of people is, like, really, PHP? How many people here use PHP? Okay, how many of you, keep your hands up if you love PHP? Okay. I get this question a lot. It's like, really, do you guys like PHP? I think there's a little bit of self-loathing going on at Facebook, because I think most of us kind of hate it. I think we're pretty realistic about it, that just like everything in life, there's some good things and some bad things. I think when you think about good things, PHP is like dirt simple to get up and running. Even a programmer who's never seen PHP before can be fixing bugs on their first week of work at Facebook and getting stuff going, and it's worked extraordinarily well for us in terms of building products really, really quickly, which is something we value quite highly. However, it does have some downsides. I'd say one of the biggest downsides is performance. So it is an interpreted language. Like many interpreted languages, it's not the fastest. Even amongst interpreted languages, it's actually pretty good. You know, best Python a bit on this benchmark. Obviously, all benchmarks are a little bit dicey, so because it's not necessarily benchmarking our workload. But if you think of that delta between, for example, PHP and C++, where we implement a lot of our services, you know, a 10x or 20x delta in performance on CPU is a pretty big deal when you're talking about tens of thousands of servers. And probably more importantly, you know, PHP doesn't exactly encourage great programming practices. We've done a lot of things to try and overcome the performance aspects of PHP. I won't go into a lot of detail on these, but lots of work, particularly on, for example, caching, efficient caching of the opcodes, and kind of tuning the environment of how that works. And this is an area where we continue to optimize. But I want to kind of get into some of the meat of what we do. So services is, when I talked about multi-view, when you think of service, it's a network service that provides some kind of domain-specific functionality. And this is an evolving philosophy at Facebook, but what we're trying to do is make it really easy for any individual or any team to run off and build the service they need in order to accomplish the function they're trying to do. And we're trying to be basically as agnostic about this as possible, meaning you can use the right tool for the job. So if you look at the services that are powering Facebook, I'd say a large portion of them are C++, because it's a lot of what our programmers are used to. There's a couple in Erlang. One big one is the chat backend. So if you use Facebook chat, you know, a couple billion messages, a little over a billion messages a day go through Facebook chat, is running through a pretty small number of Erlang servers. There is some C, there's some Python. It's kind of right tool for the job. And what we've done is we've really tried to build the basic building blocks that make it easy for you conceptually, if you're trying to write a service, to like get right down to writing the main and not have to worry about all the rest of the stuff. And so there's a couple of core building blocks we built, the first of which is called Thrift. Thrift is open source, by the way, in use by a lot of other companies now, Last.fm and a few others, is basically an RPC protocol that's cross-language that allows us to bind different services together and make procedure calls between them. But what we've done with Thrift is not just done the RPC. We've actually built a bunch of protocol implementations. We've built a bunch of server frameworks. So if it's like, I need a kind of asynchronous server or stat, like I've got a toolkit of code that I can just check out, start cranking on my main, and I'm basically ready to go. And so this is kind of our philosophy of providing each developer, hey guys, there's seats down here if you don't want to sit on the stairs. Kind of build the right building blocks to allow people to build their services. Another really core thing when you're running a high-scale environment is logging. You need to log all sorts of interesting stuff, including error messages on the web tier, and you need to analyze and aggregate those logs. Like many things we did, we started the simple way, which is syslog. Syslog really just didn't scale for us, so we built something called Scribe, which is also open source, which is a hierarchical logging system, which uses intermediate nodes to do aggregation. It will replicate, it will try and write to local disk, or store it in RAM if it needs to. It deals with failure a lot better. And this is how we do a lot of our core logging on the site, so we can aggregate that data later and analyze it. And then there's a lot of other bits of running a service at scale on a site like Facebook. Like, for example, I have to configure these services. They may run on boxes with different amounts of RAM, or I may have to configure runtime parameters. You don't want to be like editing an XML file on a production web server. You want a systematic way to analyze this, to store it, to do this across clusters. So we have things like SMC, which allows us to configure our services. Then, of course, you need to monitor them, see how they're performing, figure out when you need to add more capacity. So we've built all of the core frameworks and toolkits so that you as an engineer, it's like, hey, I want to go build a chat server, I want to go build a new search index, I want to build something that powers the homepage. You spend as much time as possible thinking about that problem rather than thinking about, all right, how do I actually get this on a machine and how do I get logs back? All that stuff is mostly taken care of for you. And that allows us to build new services very quickly to power different pieces of the site. So I want to talk about probably the most exciting of these services, which is multi-feed. So I already showed you this in terms of, again, thinking of your home page. This is the key question of, given tens of thousands of actions across maybe hundreds of friends, how do I find the 45, you know, in 10, 20, 60 milliseconds, and do that a couple billion times a day. And that's the problem that multi-feed solves. Multi-feed is, as I said, a custom distributed system that we've built. And I'll take you through a couple of the kind of basic examples. So what I want to take you through is just, let's say one person updates their status, who's a friend of mine, then I load my home page and I want to see that status update. So the way this works is, any crypto fans out there? Bob and Alice? Yeah? Shout out crypto. All right.
Crypto.
So, sorry, it's a bad security joke. So let's say Bob updates their status, goes on to the main website, updates. We go through PHP, which is our main application server. This gets pushed into our storage cluster through MySQL, but it also gets pushed through Scribe, actually, through our multi-feed environment. And the way multi-feed is set up is there's a set of leaf node servers, which is basically holding a cache of the last n actions of a set of users. N is about 50 right now, I think, right? Mm-hmm. So each of these nodes is a fairly dense set of actions for that last user. Since it's only the last 50 actions, we can build a small number of leaf servers that actually covers the entire social graph, and that's stored in this environment. Then when Alice comes through and wants to load her home page, what happens is she first hits our PHP tier, which then makes a call out through Thrift to our multi-feed, what we call our aggregator server, which then goes and makes a set of queries to the leaf nodes and basically says, here's a list of Alice's friends. You know, give me the set of actions or events that's happened that's interesting. We do a little bit of filtering in each of the leaf nodes so we don't send back, you know, tons and tons of stories. And then the aggregator node does the final aggregation of that, sends a list of story IDs back to this PHP tier, which from the leaf nodes to the aggregator, back to the main PHP layer, and then we can do that second part that I described, which is, all right, I've got this list of stories. It's kind of, think of it as the skeleton, just a set of IDs that I can then go flush out by hitting our main memcache in my SQL cluster. So this is, you know, one of the systems that we built. It's running today, powering everyone's homepage, and doing, you know, the thing is, again, doing this a couple billion times every day, you know, in 10, 20, 60 milliseconds. So this is the kind of thing that we had to build from the ground up to scale something like Newsfeed as the site grew and as people's sense of liveliness increased. The second part of this was filling out this set of data. So how do I get more information about this story ID and figure out what's going on, what's the photo associated with it, what's the name of the photo album, all this kind of ancillary data about it. And this is the thing we use Memcache for. How many of you have used Memcache or caching systems, anything like it? Awesome. So I think like many things in computer science, Memcache is beautiful in its simplicity. It's basically, for those who haven't used it, think of like a wicked fast in-memory hash table. It's conceptually what Memcache is. It runs, it uses regular RAM to store data. It's got a really great interface to it across the network where I can basically stuff keys into it and request them later. And so this is a fantastic way to cache data so you don't actually have to hit a database or hit a spinning magnet in order to load your web page. And it's something we've used quite extensively throughout Facebook. It does have a lot of advantages. It's wicked fast, relatively reliable, but it's also a fairly basic programming model. It's like building lots of stuff on top of hash tables. And it's also fragile. If you stick a bad key into Memcache, you can kind of cause problems on a pretty grand scale. Memcache is an open source project. It wasn't created by us. We used it early on in the site. Once the site started opening up to the world, realized we needed to scale it out. We first installed it on a box, and the site continued to grow. We just realized there was so much more we needed out of Memcache. So again, same story. Small set of engineers decided to start kind of peeling apart Memcache and figuring out what they could do to speed it up. And this is actually a subset of the optimizations that have happened in Memcache. All of this has been contributed back to the open source community. But to give you a sense of where we started and where we ended up with, Box is now running Memcache on the same hardware from the original version of Memcache to the one we're running today, are running at about 5 times the throughput. So pushing a lot of data through those boxes, and that's everything from, you know, breaking some of the scalability barriers through multi-threading, removing central locks, switching from TCP to UDP, lots of different things built on the software to allow it to scale. I think the fun thing about scalability challenges is you don't really know what's going to break until you run it. So the thing that happened with Memcache was we got so good at scaling Memcache that we found a bottleneck somewhere else in the system. Spun up these Memcache boxes, we had them running at really, really high throughputs, stuck them on our network, and we started crashing our network switches. Because basically, you query this data at very high rate from this web server, and the challenge is you don't actually know how much data is going to come back. Because you know, I'm going to go off and say, give me, you know, what's going on with these following friends or the status updates. I don't actually know on the web tier. If I knew what the data was, I wouldn't be asking for it. So I don't know whether I'm going to get one result back or 30 or 10 bytes or, you know, a kilobyte back from each server. These Memcache servers were able to process the request so quickly, they would basically create, for those of you who know networking, an incast problem, where you basically have this storm of data coming in, all arriving to the inbound port on the switch where the web server is connected to, and you literally exceed the instantaneous bandwidth of the switch, even though they're gigabit Ethernet switches, and the switch starts dropping packets, which is a really, really bad problem, especially when you're using UDP. So, so we had to look at how to solve this. So the way we had to solve this is basically client-side throttling. Is on the client, on a proxy we use on the web servers, we basically said, all right, we can get a sense of dropped packets or dropped keys and understand based on that window what's happening and scale back the number of requests. So if I know that I'm going to go pound 6 Memcache servers and ask them for a bunch of data, and then I don't get all the data back, I can basically do a sliding window, say, next time I do a query, let's do 4 instead or 2 instead. Yeah, you have a question?
Yeah, so you said you implemented UDP with Memcache, right? So
yeah.
My question is, UDP is obviously unreliable, so... Yeah. Did you take the approach of trying to recreate TCP's like flow control semantics, or did you just drop it and try again if you don't get a UDP response correct back?
So we don't replicate all of the TCP semantics on this. In many cases, we'll just drop it and try again for certain things, and we're not interested in the full connection. We also, in many cases, can get the entire data set back in like one packet on the switch.
Yeah.
So we don't have this. Sometimes it is increasingly not true because the data set gets bigger, it may span multiple packets. We've looked at TCP versus UDP several times. We actually just ran a series of tests to figure out whether we should switch back to TCP. One of the problems with TCP is there's so many connections open that literally just the memory required to do the connection handling reduces the amount of memory on the Memcache box we can use for caching to a significant amount. So even at the same kind of performance level, it's not making as good use of the boxes. And the tests we ran, you know, we can do as good as we can with UDP. The other thing is we have understanding at the application layer. So we're doing kind of, we can do retries at a key level if we want to versus a packet level, which is kind of more efficient. So this client-side throttling saved our switches. And happy switches makes a happy website. Yes, question in the back.
Hey, when you say client-side throttling, what is it? What is the impact of actual site then if you're dropping a request? I mean, you're dropping a request on the floor, right?
No, because we'll retry the request. So what it actually means is on a very busy time on the site, so when we're hitting peak load, our web servers will tend to request multiple rounds of data from the Memcache nodes. And so your page time will actually go up a bit. And during off-peak hours, when there's more capacity in the system, we'll actually request a wider window of data, and the page time, as a result, will be faster. So we do retry if we miss something, so you won't see the errors as a user. This is just us kind of adaptive. Basically, it's an adaptive algorithm to understand how much bandwidth we have in the switch at the time in order to produce it. So you wouldn't see it as a user. Yeah?
Do you apply optimization like optimize for time and volume of both? At least in low breadth of tape while what's on the screen is already...
We do that at a different layer, so we added, actually just in the last couple of months, delayed scroll loading. You'll notice this if you load your home page, you'll see just at the top of the fold, and there's a little bit below the fold, but if you actually start scrolling down, we'll actually start loading in the rest of the page. But that's done at the application level, it's not done at the Memcache level. But we're avoiding all of the data fetches for that bottom part until we need to, and it causes basically faster client-side rendering. Yeah?
Are you kind of stuffing the UDP packets? You have a lot of small item data, can you just send them one at a time, or do you package them into the packets kind of to make more use of each packet?
I don't actually know if the proxies, any of you guys know if the proxies do coalescing of the...
Some batching, yeah.
Yeah, so it sounds like we do some batching of it.
Small windows, but yeah, some there's batching if we know there's an outstanding request. We know there's an outstanding request into the Memcache server.
Yeah, if we know that there's an outstanding request coming to the Memcache server, like we, you know, we'll wait till we have a full response or a certain timeout to batch those back. Over you.
I will take one more Memcache question. If there, I thought I saw someone else with their hand up. Yeah.
So you mentioned that the memory required for the TCP connection was taking a lot of space. Do you terminate the connection from the client, the HP client, or is this all the way from? I'm surprised that you have a large number of TCP connections for a box. If you are terminating the TCP connection somewhere in your network.
Yeah, so this isn't, so two things. One is our web servers outnumber our Memcache servers by a lot. So because the Memcache servers can, and I'll talk in a second about kind of density of keys in the same box and how that impacts things, but the ratio is pretty high for web servers to memcache nodes, so it's a lot of web servers banging a small number of memcache nodes. And we do terminate the connections. There's actually a proxy between the PHP layer and the memcache nodes that we wrote, we call MC proxy, that handles a lot of the connection management from the app tier to the memcache nodes. So there's a couple more things on memcache. So because the other thing is how you use and cluster your data. You know, conceptually, when you think about how you want to cluster your data, if you're doing lots of big object reads, you want to spread them apart. If you have lots of small objects, you want to jam them together so you get kind of efficiencies as trying to batch up the requests on this. The thing that's interesting for Facebook is most of our objects are small. We're not storing like photos or videos in memcache. These are little snippets of data about people, maybe a status update, maybe their name, maybe some other information. So if you think about how you'd store these on a memcache node, you know, I've got my PHP client conceptually and I'm touching a memcache node and I've got 10 objects on there. The challenge is, for most people, again, what you say is you just horizontally scale. Let's say this memcache box is overloaded and can't actually process all the requests. You say, okay, great, let's like spin up another one and like just split the data in half, and then we're off and running. The problem with really, really small objects in memcache is your transaction time, your kind of communication back and forth, really trumps the work the box does in order to retrieve a very small amount of memory out of RAM and stuff it on the network socket. So when you actually split this up, you don't actually increase the processing time at all. So from the web tiers node, this takes just as long to request in parallel from these two boxes. And by the way, the actual compute you're doing is increased because each of these two boxes is processing two requests instead of one box for processing one request. And this gets on and on and gets worse and worse as you take this like very small horizontal data set and try and split it apart. So we did what every good computer scientist does when you reach a problem like this, is you run a bunch of tests. You probably can't, oh, you actually can read this. What we decided to do was take one web server and have it request different batches of keys, different amounts of keys at one time to different cluster sizes to basically figure out what's the optimal cluster size we can get in order to both maximize utilization and response time. And you can see, I don't know if you can read the key, but the green line there is basically 50 keys per batch. And if you can read the chart at the bottom, you can see right around 2 to 3 nodes, basically 2 to 4 nodes, requesting 50 keys in a batch is the optimal in terms of, you know, maximizing the throughput of the entire system. So what we decided to do is look at our data and see how we could break and partition our data into clusters that allow us to run a couple of node clusters that can respond to lots of requests. I spent the first half of this talk talking about how our data is all interconnected and it's very difficult to separate, and that's very true. We looked at geography, we looked at school networks. There's always something that crosses those boundaries. So if you try and partition on that, you will eventually run out of luck. Someone will hit a query that crosses the boundary. So what we instead decided to do is try and take charts through object type. So trying to look at types of objects that would tend to be accessed together. So there's one, for example, we call a short profile, which is a very small amount of information about a user. And it's a small enough amount of information that we can actually take all of our users and stuff that into a handful of boxes, basically, and store them all in RAM. So that if I'm, for example, trying to build a friends list of all my friends on my friends page and get their full names and any network information, I can basically, as a web server, go touch a couple of memcache nodes, ask each one of them for maybe a couple hundred friends, and get all of that data back, and get very high utilization because I'm asking for lots of objects at once. This has a big problem, though, which is I've created this very small cluster that if one of the shards in the cluster goes down, basically I'm going to take down part of the website. So, of course, I've got to add replication on top of that. So you can have multiple of these clusters replicated throughout, so you can do maintenance on one, or if you have an issue on one, you can just redirect the traffic somewhere else. And then, of course, you need a fallback cluster for the bigger, wider data set that may not exist in there. So if I'm actually trying to get more detailed information about a user, I would go to a different, call it the wildcard or the fallback cluster. And so this is one way to partition our data so we can get very high utilization of these boxes for requesting certain types of data. So that's memcache. I'll talk about databases real quick, and then I'll wrap up, and we can take lots of questions and bring the engineers on up. So databases. MySQL is our primary data store. Use it from the beginning because it's free, it's easy to install. It's actually quite fast for many of the operations. And our basic strategy here is to end the presentation. All right. Basic strategy here is to use lots and lots of distributed MySQL databases. This means that all of our users are basically partitioned across these different databases. So you are probably on a different database than I. And we call these things the user databases. There's thousands of them, basically, so our users are all split into each of these different databases. And it means that we can get some great scalability because we're not trying to query like one huge, ginormous Oracle database. But it causes a lot of challenges because if you think about it, if you're friends with me and we're on different physical databases, joins don't really help me. I can't use most of the features of a relational database. So our MySQL usage really looks like a very fancy key value store that allows you to return some stuff and maybe do some sorting and some other queries. That's a generalization, but you can't really do many joins in production because this data is all separated. So why use MySQL at all, a lot of people ask. The good thing about MySQL is it's actually, for what it does, extraordinarily reliable. I asked all the team, we couldn't find an event where MySQL corrupted any data for us. And it's used, as I'll discuss later, heavily in order to do replication across data centers for reliability and performance. And MySQL replication is a really kind of well-understood, battle-tested thing. And it's very easy to administer. Easy to get people to understand how to back up a database, how to do a hot failover, all of these things. When you're talking about actual user data, which is really critical, this is actually one of the most important things. The other thing that's interesting about data stores is there's a real tension, I don't know if anyone else has noticed this, between fast and joyful to program. Those two don't always come together, and that's very annoying. To give you a specific example, data-driven schemas are a lot of fun as a programmer. That means I don't have to call the DBA and tell them to make a couple thousand new tables across all my databases and verify the indices are right. I can just like start stuffing data into a database. And so we built a couple of different models for data-driven schemas where I can just create new objects and start stuffing them into our databases. I can actually create associations between objects. So when we launched the like feature in February of this year, it uses an internal framework that allows us to quickly associate two pieces of data. So associate me to a post, for example, is what a like basically is. And that was done without any schema changes because we use data-driven schemas, tables that grow. The problem with that is this means that as a DBA, when you're looking at the database, you don't actually understand what the data is because the schema doesn't describe it. It's just like ID1, ID2, and some other junk. And so you don't exactly know how it's accessed. So this is something that I think we've been struggling with a bit is in the long run, we want to optimize for programmer productivity because moving fast in a consumer environment is very, very, very important to us. But it does come with some trade-offs in terms of kind of tuning to the metal or hand-wiring your schema. The other thing we learned, unfortunately, several times is in a scale like ours, like centralized is bad. So there are a couple of places where we had, it's just easier. You kind of, maybe you're doing an A-B test and you need to kind of centralize the storage or the results of that. To have a couple of databases that you can guarantee that these are the ones where all the data is. Well, in a sidebar scale, if you ever end up relying on that feature too much, you can easily take down those databases and that will cause you site issues. So everything we try and do these days, we try and replicate out as much as possible. And the last thing is our MySQL cluster, again, even though it's a couple thousand nodes, like our Memcache cluster, pales in comparison to the size of our web cluster. And that, in many ways, is a good thing. It's a lot easier to add lots of new web servers than it is to bring up new databases. The hardware is cheaper. Administration model is very easy. So if you can scale, like if you're going to burn CPU, on the web tier is a good place to do it. On the database tier is probably not a good place to do it. And so that's worked generally very well for us. So just to kind of wrap this up, when you think about the overall architecture of Facebook in terms of this web server, this Memcache, and this MySQL, really what it starts to look like is a data store, as I said, kind of key value data store, a place where we actually do the joins. So you're actually doing the joins in production basically on the app server, on the web server cluster, and a secondary index where I may be fetching my data at high performance. So that's kind of at a high level the way we think of these things. And it's used and allowed us to scale to, again, 300 plus million users. So last thing I want to cover on architecture stuff, and then we'll take a lot more questions, is I think the other really big challenge, as I said, with this huge growing interconnected data set, is how do you bring it to the whole world? If you remember the heat map in the very beginning, 70% of our users outside the US, and that's growing every day. So serving all of those users from the US is kind of a problem. So we've took a pretty creative approach, I think we call it a hack, to make our data scale across multiple data centers. And this is one of the many areas where we're kind of like on revision 2 and like we need to get to revision 4 very quickly of it. But I'll take you through it. We actually have a couple of data centers in the West Coast, mostly because we were buying them very rapidly and it was hard to get the size we needed all at once, and so we kind of bought it incrementally. But the really, really interesting thing, and I'll skip the West Coast for a second, is when you talk about adding data centers on the East Coast. So we have a fairly big presence in Virginia as well. So we're on the West Coast and on the East Coast. West Coast serves, obviously, the West Coast of the United States and Asia. East Coast serves the East Coast of the U.S. and much of Europe. The big challenge here is you've got this huge interconnected set of data. You may fly to Boston tomorrow and update your status, and I may load my page here, and I want to see it, right? And as I said, there's no easy way to partition this, so I can't just assign you to Boston and like pretend that I can't actually see your status updates anymore. We've got to find some way to reconcile that data. So this hack that we did, that was one engineer with the cooperation of a bunch of engineering over a couple of months, I think he joined and we're like, hey, can you solve this multi-data center problem for us? Awesome, thanks, go, you're ready to go. And so he went off and did that, and what we ended up doing is plugging into the MySQL replication. So we replicate our databases across the coast, and then we plugged into the replication protocol to allow us to basically invalidate the memcache keys on the East Coast. So if you think about the way this works is, if you're on the East Coast and you update your status, what ends up happening is, and I don't know if we have this on the diagram, nope, we don't have it on the diagram, but what ends up happening is it looks like a West Coast master with an East Coast read slave, where if you're doing read operations on the East Coast, we can just serve you right up through the same kind of memcache MySQL infrastructure that we'd have on the West Coast. If you need to update your status, you'll actually get redirected back to the West Coast through a series of proxies, or we'll then write the data into the West Coast, re-replicate that across to the East Coast, and clear out any keys in memcache that's on the East Coast. With some magic, this all sounds well and good, except that a very common use case, probably some of you have done this, is like you update your status, and then you run to your profile and be like, ah, did I type that in right to make sure it looks okay, or did my photo get uploaded? And so a read after a write is an extraordinarily common operation. So we have to do some magic to make sure that you can see that read right away, you know, a second or two after you make the update and send you to the West Coast to do so. So this is an active area. I see a hand up there in a second. I'm going to wait, and we'll take questions at the end, because I'll just blaze through the rest of this, and then there'll be lots of questions. But this is an active area of research for us in terms of how to build better data stores to scale to not just two, but you know, hopefully four or six data centers in the near future. I think the other really awesome thing about Facebook infrastructure and architecture is we open source pretty much all the major pieces of software. So I think we've open sourced nearly 20 projects. Some of them very major, some of them are small JavaScript utilities and others. But you know, we recently open sourced Tornado, which is a Python web framework that the FriendFeed team, company we acquired, had built. Shortly after we acquired them, we open sourced it. I talked about Thrift and Scribe. Those are on our website, ready for you to use if you want them. For those of you who are into data processing and use Hadoop, we're heavy committers to that and have built Hive and a couple of other things on top of Hadoop. And then, of course, we contribute to Memcache and MySQL and many others. So if you go to devfacebook.com/open source, you can get a sense of these projects and use them for yourself. We've also been building an increasingly numerous set of systems like Cassandra, which is a storage system, and many others that we will continue to open source as we go. So last thing I want to talk about is kind of the Facebook engineering culture. A lot of people ask when they come and interview, what's it like to work at Facebook? And we've been talking internally a lot about culture in Facebook, because I think it's one of the most important things long-term in a company is, like, how does this company operate? How does it ship product? You know, I personally believe there are very few long-term technology competitive advantages where you can kind of sit on your laurels and like, okay, I figured out the scaling problem, that's how we win, because the market changes over time. And so I think the thing we value more than anything is our ability to adapt and innovate, both in products and in technology, more rapidly than anyone else. We want to be able to launch features faster than someone, you know, to 300 million users, faster than someone can do it to 0 million users. So this is probably the number one thing we talk about in engineering, which is what we call move fast and break stuff. It's usually the break stuff part of this quote that confuses people, and they say, really, do you mean that? What does that mean exactly? And it means that we're trying to create an environment where, in order to have innovation, you have to take risks. If you take risks, it means you will fail. If you never fail, it means you're not taking risks and you're not really trying to innovate. And so we've tried to set up a structure where individuals can take risks on systems, on projects, on features, and the organization can catch them if they fail. So there's been a number of instances where we had a summer intern, you know, cause some issues on the site because they were trying something new out. And that's not something that's necessarily scorned. It's something that's like, hey, you know, good job trying to get this done. Let's see what else we can do to make it so that you know, these problems don't happen in the future. But to the individual, it's really the risk-taking, the desire to do innovation and try something new that's rewarded, not the, you know, don't screw anything up mantra that a lot of companies get themselves into, and I think that's how they back themselves into a corner in terms of not innovating. I think this is the other big thing for us is we run a pretty lean engineering organization and something we're immensely proud of. one of the numbers I track, we call it an engineering leverage ratio. It's the number of users to the number of engineers at Facebook. The number is somewhere around 1.1 million, 1.2 million to 1. So a couple hundred million users, a couple hundred engineers. We've been growing our engineering team, this is part of why we're having this event here tonight, very, very rapidly over the last year, but our user growth has outpaced our engineering growth. And this is really, really important because it means that every single person at the company has a huge impact on what they can do. Most of the projects I talked about here, actually all of them, I actually polled the engineering team, it's like, find me a project that had more than 8 people working on it. And like everyone scratched their heads like, nah, don't have one. You know, median project size is 1 to 3 engineers. And that's a really, really important thing because it means we can, again, move fast and you as a new engineer, a new team, can get there and ship something on this site to a couple hundred million people, you know, in the first couple months of your work. And then the last thing is, and this is kind of part of move fast, is being bold and innovating. So whether it's Haystack, whether it's multi-feed, whether it's continually changing the homepage, we want to make sure we're willing to try something new and not have an over attachment to the things we've done in the past, whether it be product, whether it be technology, to make sure we're always looking for the next best solution and not just doing what we did before to make sure we can continue to win. This is the engineering leverage ratio. These are very conservative numbers for these other companies. If you work at one of these companies, I'm sorry, I'm not making fun of you. It's just, like, I was trying to get a sense of order of magnitude, and it's just off the charts. I actually can't find a company that's anywhere near our leverage ratio. That, I think, is a really big determinant of what it's like to work at Facebook. It means it's a little crazy and chaotic and scary at times, but it means that if you don't show up for work, it's really going to matter. And that's something that I think I and everyone else there really enjoy. And the last thing is, like, why do we build all this technology? At the end of the day, it's to build really awesome products. So whether it be status tagging, started by one engineer at a hackathon, whether it be our iPhone, written by one engineer, it's the most popular free iPhone app, has been for many, many months. Like.facebook.com is like, hey, let's build a totally separate version of our site, super optimized for performance for low bandwidth markets. You know, this was a handful of engineers over 11 weeks, launched a fully functional, you know, clone of Facebook, basically, to allowing people to search their own streams and, you know, get this information and do search indexed by my friend's network so I can find posts, you know, sorted by their relevance to me. These are all projects written by small teams in many months, not many years, shipped this year. So that's it. That's hopefully a tour at a super high level. We've got a bunch of the Facebook engineers here who know a lot more about many of these systems if you have questions or products or what it's like to be at Facebook. So you guys want to come up here? We'll make some chairs up here and make you uncomfortable. Everyone's tired of listening to me, yeah. So questions about technology, architecture, Facebook? Yeah?
MySQL, what storage engine do you use?
InnoDB. Question was MySQL, what do we use? We use InnoDB. Some InnoDB fans in the house? Yeah? MyISOM? No? You wanna duke it out? All right.
MyISOM support transactions.
Hey, you said somewhere in the middle of the presentation you talked about how
people might implement that, but I guess not.
Yeah.
So how do you do that? Like, I don't use MySQL, so I don't know. Does MySQL have like a replication mode?
Yeah, MySQL has built-in replication that actually works pretty well.
Sorry, not MySQL. Memcache. You said replicas and memcache data.
Ah, replicas and memcache. Sorry. Who here wants to talk about memcache replication? Buzz, or I can do it. Everyone's like, no. There is no built-in replication protocol for Memcache, so we basically do it at usually at the application level. So we'll have a server actually set the key in multiple places, in multiple replicas, and then we configure the servers to kind of spread the load out. Boz, you didn't want to talk before, but now you do. Okay.
It's a really small number of keys that we have to do that for. Like the application is almost all, you're almost always aware as the application developer when your application has a key that's going to fit the kind of profile where you need to have a really small, high bandwidth access, like pattern data set, and you need to replicate it. So it's actually pretty easy. It's pretty easy to do in our code, but again, it's all application layer, not a Memcache layer.
Can I ask a follow-up to that?
Yes.
So how do you deal with data inconsistency if the app is responsible for like doing the replication? What happens if like the server goes down in the middle of operation?
Yeah, you want to talk about data inconsistency, Buzz? I just want to make him walk all the way back over here.
This is not a fluid setup. That happens all the time. If the data inconsistency is something that we don't deal with, again, it's all the application layer. So when we talk about, in this presentation, you really get this right, like when you think about databases as being like a really pretty dumb persistence layer, ultimately is the arbiter of all consistency issues, we really rely on the application to do the proper dirtying. So one of the kind of funny things they talked about in the cross-coast replication scenario that they kind of glossed over is we have to attach our cache dirties. We had to modify MySQL to accept, hey, by the way, here's the key that is tied to this of the caching layer, so that when it replicates that across the coast, then the MySQL instance on the other coast will then replay the cache dirty to make sure that it's always got the right data. So, yeah, this is, again, we're moving rapidly towards a world where this is something that's much more automatic. But right now we rely a lot more, we rely on the application developer to have a pretty deep awareness of how these systems work. It's definitely not like a set it and forget it kind of situation. It's like you have to understand how our architecture works to be able to develop applications at Facebook.
Hey, while you have the microphone there, you want to introduce yourself and talk about what you work on Facebook and then hand it on down the line?
My name is Andrew Bosworth. People call me Boz mostly. I've been there for like 3.5 years. I started out building newsfeed, built a lot of the infrastructure pieces, and I'm currently working on the inbox messaging product.
I'm Dave Fetterman. I came down the same day as Boz from Microsoft. I worked on the platform for a long time, and now I'm the engineering manager for Facebook Mobile.
Hey, I'm Mark Tonkelowitz. I was referred to as MTonk twice earlier. I guess that's what they call me at Facebook, too. I work on the newsfeed team, basically everything above that multi-feed layer that we've been talking about. So taking those stories, figuring out what to display, how to display them, and then how to do it efficiently on the homepage.
Hi, I'm Ryan McElroy. I just started at Facebook about 6 weeks ago, so I'm the newest person here, I think. I just joined the databases team, so soon I will be able to answer a lot more questions.
Have you fixed code, pushed code to the live site?
I have pushed code to the live site.
How long did it take you to push your first code?
2 weeks. It was very scary.
Hi, I'm Greg Batters. I am grateful that Ryan started, so I'm no longer the newest person here. I've been at Facebook about 4 months, and I work with the monetization and data infrastructure teams.
I'm Luke Shepard. I worked at the supply chain at Amazon. I came here about 2.5 years ago. I work with third-party application developers, primarily on Facebook Connect.
I'm Brian Stedman. I came here a little over a year ago, and I work on internal tools.
Awesome. Good. You can keep it. We've got two.
While I'm here, I just thought I'd mention, notice that the Memcache proxy on the East Coast goes up from the database. That's because, basically, to invalidate the keys, the SQL that is being replicated across has basically appended to the SQL all the Memcache keys, too. Like we said, it's a hack. We want to make it better. You can help us, maybe.
Beautiful hack. All right, question up here.
Things in terms of like technology and infrastructure that Facebook does better than Google, and what are two things that Google does better than Facebook?
So the question is really putting me on the spot. Greta knows that I used to work at Google and asked one or two things about the infrastructure at Facebook that's better than Google and one or two things that is less good than Google. Is that right?
We are taping this, Greg.
Yes. So let's see. I'll start with the better then, because that comes to mind so much faster. I think the speed at which we're able to move because of this very flexible and very simple Memcache architecture is the thing that certainly has taken the most adjusting to. It's a layer that Google has nothing really close to. At the same kind of scale. So that's something that really has enabled code to evolve very, very quickly, and I really think is a big part of how fast we're able to move at Facebook. I remember when I first started at Facebook, I was meeting with one small team, like 3 or 4 people, and they're like, yeah, you know, this is going to take us forever, man. I was like, well, you know, tell me, what do you think? How long is this going to be? They're like, it probably isn't going to go out this week, maybe next week. Like, okay, that's fine. So, you know, I think that's really, really good. Was there a second part to your question? Oh, yeah, the other way around. So I think Google, let's see. That's a really hard question. This is the stalling for effect. Yeah, let's see. The consistent replication and being, you know, I think Google takes a perspective of things can go wrong because you're not going to recognize that things have gone wrong in certain cases for web search in particular. If it's way, way down in PageRank, you don't need to worry about it showing up in the search results every single time. I think we have a harder problem there, and there are a couple of hacks that make things pretty much always work, but it's not quite as certain as you might like if you were really aiming for higher levels of reliability on every single page view and so forth. But you have to make that trade-off about being able to move really, really fast and deliver those new features very, very quickly. And I think we make those trade-offs in a pretty smart way. Google, I think, is a little slower to ship things, and users pay for that.
This is the first time I've seen him sweat in 4 months of work.
Thanks for the question.
Thank you
very much.
Questions like that. All right, over there.
So I've noticed the sign-in page is not HTTPS. What are you doing to keep credentials secure?
The action is HTTPS.
Yeah. So. Credentials, they are all the post of your actual credentials is HTTPS. As it turns out, we've examined turning our login page to HTTPS, and HTTPS is much more expensive and harder to scale. Our servers, we talked about how we could scale out our web server to handle it. We can handle it. We're mostly concerned with users' browsers. They are not. It slows it down quite a bit if when they hit Facebook.com, it impacts there. So I think. I'm not sure what the official answer is. We're continually reevaluating it, and I think if it makes sense at some point in the future when browsers are able to handle it better, they might do that. But all the credentials are posted over HTTPS. In the corner over there?
In the next slide over, you show Memcache.
Previous?
The next one. You have three layers, Memcache and MySQL for storage. Are you storing the images and large data on MySQL as well?
No. No, that's images, for example, now are stored on the Haystack boxes that I talked about earlier today. It's kind of like large file blob storage. That stuff it never actually makes its way through Memcache.
Mostly read-only.
What's that?
Mostly read-only storage.
I mean, it's write once, read-only, with deletes. So people do delete photos, so we will go delete them, but... if you actually look at many of the operations on the site, for example, you may have noticed you can update your status, which is an insert, and you can delete it, but you can't edit it. So there's a lot of options that are kind of inserts and deletes, but no updates.
How does that impact the performance?
Yeah. Very well.
Yeah. Think append better than seek and update. So it helps a lot. Yeah.
What kind of real-time monitoring?
At least 30,000. What type of real-time monitoring stuff do we have?
Well, so the basics of it, so one of the key parts of it is Scribe. What I was talking about before is basically near real-time logging. It does a bunch of the logging in RAM. It does it aggregated through other tiers. All of the stuff we built is basically in-house. So we built a number of different monitoring systems for a number of different parts of the site, from monitoring performance down to the browser, to monitoring system availability, a system we call ODS, performance characteristics, and then a lot of it for us is about aggregation and statistics to understand how to get a broad view per cluster, per node, per service, per data center on what's going on in terms of CPU utilization and other things. I think the other big challenge, too, is when you're running into issues is trying to do problem identification by looking at lots of things at once. So we built lots of different ways to analyze the data and overlay different graphs. So you can say, okay, looks like the databases are hot. Why are they hot? Is there a lot of traffic happening on the network? Is it one slow query? Are the web tier also hot? Have the requests increased? Is this just user activity? Is this a bot attack? So trying to produce systems that allow us to look at lots of data at once to try and identify where in the system the issue is. Let's see, someone hasn't asked a question. In the middle there?
Yeah, so most of your slides, the servers are this big, and there's one slide where the server's this big, and I assume it's to scale. I assume it's a data warehouse, data mining sort of cube where everything goes. It's historical data, right? But what do you guys use for that? I mean, presumably you guys have lots of rich data that you want to mine, and you're not doing it on your serving clusters, so.
So yeah, we use,
following the philosophy of using open source where open source is good, we use and contribute a lot back to the Hadoop projects and the Hive projects, and that infrastructure is what we use for all of our data mining needs, and really have as good of a data warehouse as I've seen, and you know, as you well know, Steve, I came from Google, so there's lots of good stuff in the way that we do it. And the best part about using open source in this case is that there are a half dozen schools doing projects making Hadoop better, you know, research projects and other things that we're going to benefit from by the sheer fact that it's open source, and we're able to sort of have an engagement with the community around how that software is going to develop. So we're pretty excited about how it's been working for us. It's got some problems still too, but you know, the rate of innovation and improvement there is really great.
There's no big forklift upgradable machine anywhere in the architecture. So.
We do have one in the building though.
We have a crane in the building. It's not for machines.
Yeah, there's no CPU.
In the corner?
What's your services ecosystem? How many? How deep? How fast growing? How many services do you need for rendering, you know, a single homepage?
Oh, yeah, so how many services? I can't actually talk about exactly how many, but think it's a pretty good set, and it's increasing over time. It's a direction we're taking the architecture, is to actually move much more of the code out of PHP into these distributed services, which is why we spend a lot of time on building all of these foundational pieces with Rift and others. So it's increasing over time in order to do it.
How deep?
What does deep mean?
How many layers of services do you go through on a regular iteration? Is it always you get a service, you go back, or services, both services, calling services?
It really depends. I mean, it depends on how you define all of this stuff. So if you look at, Luke is about to answer, but if you look at like multi-feed, it depends on where you define the service, because you do have subqueries through different parts of the service, aggregator to leaf node and other things like that. Luke, did you want to add something?
Shrep actually knows more about the specifics of the details, but I came from Amazon, which I know has like incredibly service-oriented, like there might be, you know, hundreds of thousands of services that all call each other on a page load, maybe. Our services are more like... I think the majority of the general purpose code is primarily done on web tier, and then web memcache database, and then we use services for specialized things.
How deep is the call stack?
It's not terribly deep. Not very deep. It's not one, but it's not 20. And I think long term we're trying not to make services call services, but kind of more of a horizontal spread of those things. You can think of, there's lots of obvious places where services. So multi-feed is one that powers the homepage. Search is another one. Chat is the third one, because you're holding persistent state to see whether someone's online. And then there's a variety of other services that we're spinning up to do other things in the architecture. All right, more questions.
We're getting multiple questions.
All right, in the middle there.
Hey, so in the previous slide, how long does the actual round trip take, and from like, you know, Boston to West Coast? And do you ever update multiple pieces of data in parallel, like you have the memcache and the SQL Server at the same time, or do you wait for one to come back? Or it kind of depends on how long it takes, right?
Yeah, we have a... We're basically speed of light between the two coasts, so 70 milliseconds? No.
No, he's right. We're top-tier peering, so...
So there's not a lot of overhead there. This is about 70 milliseconds between the coasts. Fairly high reliable backplane. What was the second question? I'm sorry?
Well, no, that's good enough.
Okay. If anyone has a solution to that stupid speed of light problem, that would be awesome. Thanks. All right, let's see. We'll get to this side of the room a bit. Is there someone down here? Oh, yeah, over there. I can't see you because you're...
So, about what percentage of your data that goes through the memcache gene layer fits in the memcache gene layer?
I don't actually understand the question.
Can you fit all of your data in the
memcache? No, not even close.
Right.
So
what kind of things do you do to load balance?
Don't worry about it.
Yeah, so I'll throw out a couple stats. One is total resident working set in use in memcache, addressable today, is, think, hundreds of terabytes of RAM. Remember that the data isn't necessarily optimally organized, and there is overhead, because you have to deal with the actual hashing and all of the maintenance of the hash table within memcache, so it's not a purely optimal data storage. Our hit rates are in the high 90s in terms of loading it, in terms of querying the data. The data does tend to evolve quite a bit, and it's fairly real time, so it's like impossible to get 100% hit rates. One of the challenges with Memcache is it's effectively a look-aside cache, so the model is if I'm writing something, I'll write it into MySQL. On the next read, you'll do a look at it in MySQL, you'll miss, and then you'll basically pull it into Memcache, or you look at Memcache, I'm sorry, you'll miss, you'll hit MySQL, and then you're sticking into Memcache on your way back through.
On the way back through from the application layer?
From the application layer. So the application is going to hit MySQL, load it in, push it into Memcache, do a set, basically, and then finish rendering the page. This obviously can be optimized, so we've been looking through, looking at write-through caches, that as I write the data, I write it through the cache so that the subsequent read basically is going to, by definition, have a hit. So we're doing some modeling. A lot of this stuff sounds great in theory until you actually run it on production to see whether hit rates are actually better or not, so we're experimenting with some of that stuff now.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Sure.
And if you ever try to go back to the same Memcache V node, because you know that that box will have the key resident in memory, or you just don't care, you'll just go to the Memcache V cloud?
Yeah, I don't think that there's any kind of session affinity or stickiness to any of these things. I think we're just configured to balance out kind of the ratio of web to Memcache nodes and know which ones are going to have which data generally. All right, who has anyone had their hand up for a while that I've missed? It's hard to see. Way in the back?
Yeah, first of all, really great talk. Very technical and interesting. Two questions. First question is, you talked a lot about the various subsystems and optimizations to get data to the page, but what actually happens, who processes the PHP on the main page? Like, who digs out those queries to the subsystems?
So it's a, I'm not sure I exactly understand, so please interrupt if I have this right. Is basically it's the, you know, it's the PHP layer, so Apache with the Zend engine kind of processing, handles the main request, and then is effectively our app layer. So it is going to send requests out to the different services. It's going to go hit Memcache and MySQL, get the data back, do any processing it needs to do on it, assemble the data, and actually generate the web page there. So it's a fairly flat architecture in the sense that that node is doing a lot of work. This is one of the reasons why the web nodes far outnumber the rest of the nodes, because most of the actual data processing where you're actually kind of joining data together or doing any kind of post-filtering on it is happening at the web tier. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, kind of, but like, is there a physical machine that you're sitting on and it, you know, reads out these queries and then they come back? Or is it virtualized across many systems?
Yeah, I mean, you basically get load balanced as a user. You go through a set of load balancers. You get, for a specific request, you get sent to a web box. That web box is basically going to do all of the requests, sub-requests, in order to assemble that page, get all the data back, and then send the page back to the user. So it's like a one request, assemble all the data, send it back out to the user.
So if you have slow services, then those machines will be quite a bit idle while they wait for that get data to gather.
Yes.
So my second question is, if you were to throw a party in Seattle and suddenly 100 million people join Facebook, who would be the biggest bottleneck that you would hit? If you can talk about that, of course.
What would follow it first?
I'll give you my guess. I think our best experience is like you don't actually know it's going to break until it breaks, and that's the fun part about scalability. Like we're at a scale where you just can't simulate, you know, another 200 million users on top of the existing. I'd say that if you look at the system at a very high level, it's very data intensive. So you know, a lot of the stuff we look at is, you know, as a proxy, if you can fetch less data, you will run faster. And so somewhere in the data processing layer, you know, whether it be the databases, MySQL, or the Memcache nodes or the web tiers, it's all about actually balancing these services out. You got to have them right sized. So, you know, part of it depends on capacity, where we're going. We're pretty sure the basic architecture can scale for quite a while. A lot of the things we're looking at doing is we're also pretty sure we can make it a lot more efficient and optimal in terms of how it's operating. So, you know, I think it's both been a benefit and a curse to have a generally speaking very simple system. Like, there's no complex magic trying to do data coherence across three continents, that if, like, there's some subtle bug in there, you have no idea what's going on. If you look at the basic building blocks, they're very, very simple. MySQL, Memcache, some proxies that, you know, the app servers, where you can look at all the code for all the systems. And I think that's actually benefited us quite a bit, because you don't tend to have these weird ghost problems. You can kind of figure out what's going on in one part of the system, and we have people who understand each of these systems very, very, very well. But we're trying to figure out places where we can store data more optimally, fetch it more optimally, which I think is going to be our biggest win in terms of efficiency. So if you look at what the CPU is doing on the web tier, it's like fetching and processing data. Just think about your homepage. Like, you'll have things on there, it's like, you know, Starbucks coffee, 60 of your friends are also fans. And just think of that, kind of that little icon there that's in the corner is basically us intersecting your friend set with what might be millions of fans of this page. And like fetching all that data and figuring out what that count is a very expensive operation, and doing that multiple times per page. So there's ways to build systems that can store data that do this kind of processing much more optimally.
So my last question, I'm sorry to hijack you, but it sounds like you guys are pretty CPU bound on the PHP processor. Are you doing any conversions to C++ or another language that runs 50 times faster to save on hardware costs?
Do you know of a language that runs 50 times faster?
Looked like C++ was
25 times, yeah. Still good enough. We'll take it. Yeah, we do have a number of projects to look at heavily optimizing PHP. So, and a couple that are looking very promising. All right, way in the stairs over there.
So you guys have released several updates to the website over time, and I've noticed that those updates have been met with mixed reactions, shall we say. I'm curious if you have a system in place to expose the updated website to a slice of your user base, and how that works to gauge sort of customer feedback or experience.
Yeah, the question was, for those who didn't hear it, was released a number of new changes to the site, met with, and he's being very nice, mixed reactions. You know, did we actually look at that at all before we pushed it, or we just say, like, let's damn the torpedoes and see what happens? The answer is we do have a fairly sophisticated set of A-B testing frameworks that we use quite extensively to test features for different user sets before they roll out. This happens for micro features, and you want to talk about the homepage we just rolled out? Because we did, this is an example of us doing actually extensive user testing, both at multiple levels. So we'll do user testing in a user lab where we bring people in and we have either rough mocks or something kind of working to get more qualitative feedback, like do they understand what's going on? And then we'll actually do data measurements where we'll do A-B tests, run different versions of the site for different users, and then I look at the metrics and see how often are they updating their status, you know, how often are they logging into the site, and look at a range of metrics to see whether the new version is more optimal in some regard than the other. So we do that quite extensively, much more over time. Sometimes it has unintended side effects. We actually did a forced A-B test of people to the Lite site to see what that would look like, to lite.facebook.com. One of the missing features of the Lite site is the platform. Any Farmville fans here? People have farms here? We got a number. So didn't mean to do this, but we got a number of really nasty notes saying, "Help, please, my strawberries are dying on my farm. Can you please let me back to the main Facebook site?" So, yeah. Don't mean to cause harm on the way to testing, but yes, we A-B test quite a bit.
Sure.
Down in the front, right here.
I've got two questions. One is, you mentioned quantity of hardware. Do you use it in configurations? I mean, for example, you mentioned terabytes of data in memory. What are your machines, some of your machines look like? You can talk about that.
What do you define as exotic?
Well, that stat was about across a bunch of servers.
I understand.
Or like a bunch.
That's the double bunch. I get that. Yeah.
A bunch.
How commodity are these servers? I mean, are they really just sort of normal and you just stack up the RAM or what?
I mean, they're commodity in the sense that it's all Intel-based, you know, boxes, all running Linux. We source from a number of different vendors. We're buying enough these days that we can be very specific about the configurations we want, and we try to keep only a handful of configurations around. You know, there's configuration for database, configuration for memcache, and configuration for the web tier. And you can be creative. Like, for us, it's being creative about cost. So sizing the RAM on the box is basically a cost equation. Like, if you get above a certain DIMM size, the price curve basically goes really nuts on you in a bad way. So the boxes are sized specifically to be at the right price-performance ratio in the memcache tier for a number of DIMM slots, and thus the amount of RAM you can stick on the box. There isn't anything super crazy exotic on those boxes, but the haystack boxes, we're getting more and more specific about the exact configurations we need for different kind of purposes in the data center.
The other question I had was third-party applications. All that we were talking about was about the actual, you know, Facebook page. I would guess that some of the third-party applications would stress weird parts of the system in ways you guys did plan for. Have you run into that? And can you give me an example of something where, like...
Do you want to take this, Luke?
Sure. So the API runs through the same framework as the rest of the tier, and our API... Basically, I mean, we have a language called FQL, which allows for access to user data. And so for the most part, applications like have some varied things. One example of a weird request we had is we have Canvas pages on the site, which are basically that instead of the user going to the application directly, they go to Facebook, and then we turn around and we ping that site and get some HTML back or some FBML back and then convert it into HTML and send it back to the user. So that was a weird circumstance where we found that we had like a bunch of... There was a weird thing where if a big application had slightly worse performance, we would have a ton of open HTTP connections from essentially our API tier. And because our tiers are single-threaded, you know, that can really stress things out. So we had to do some special stuff around that. But, you know, so that we aren't dying on tons of open curl connections to just random applications. So, I mean, we sort of have to do some timeouts to protect ourselves from applications that behave poorly. But I think for the most part, it's our application traffic is diverse enough and our web traffic is diverse enough that it more or less goes to the same stack.
Cool. What do you in the middle?
Given that you're growing so quickly and pushing features so quickly, how do you kind of keep a lid on operations and shield your developers from having to put out fires all the time?
It's a great question. Does someone, I've been talking a lot, does anyone want to take this or can we talk about it?
I think we should get it. Sure. Well, as you see, sometimes that you can't shield everything, and sometimes things do go down because the new guy came in 6 weeks and went and did this. But he goes for it because we told him go for it, and he breaks some things, and that's fine. Some of the things that naturally we have are we're replicated data. We've also built this reusable layer. So you guys use the LAMP stack, right? Like a lot of you are pretty familiar with what that is. You're maybe possibly building your businesses on that because it's a reusable thing that has been applied many different places effectively and has been hardened over time. So like what Shrek was talking about, at least in the more complicated systems problems, was we have our own stack sort of layer on top of that. That includes IPC like Thrift, distributed logging like Scribe, different big data access libraries like Haystack or Hive or Cassandra, all these really neat things, so that we can solve this problem once and apply it to many different systems at the same time. So in a certain way, we built something for 300 million users, but you constrain the problem by making it modular and reusing things, which is just a normal technique in software. So now to the question of, Do things screw up and do we have to roll things back in the middle of the push? Yes, that does happen. But we have a lot of people looking at it. We're pretty quick about being able to fix things, so we're not deploying like huge binaries most of the time. Like a lot of the things that turn a new feature on or off are in an interpreted language, possibly routing to one of these services that are on the back end, so that the deployment, the rollout is not as big a deal. On feature-wise, as it could be. So there's a lot of ways that, a lot of different interpretations of why we're able to maintain a pretty solid system, but that's a few things that probably contribute to it being okay.
Yeah, and just to call out two specific examples of things that really surprised me as far as making my life easier, were Scribe and our real-time configuration mechanism, where we use APC basically to cache configuration. So, like Federman alluded to, when we push a new feature, we usually just push the code out and then flip a switch and turn it on, and we've got this down to where you can flip a switch and have it all across the entire web tier, that value propagated, within, like, I think a couple seconds, maybe like a minute.
Less than a couple seconds.
Okay, really, really fast. That was one thing that surprised me when I came here, is they were having discussions, and they were like, oh man, our APC upload is taking so long, and it was all the way up to like 15 or 20 seconds, and they had to get it down to like a few seconds because it was just impossible to work with that kind of environment. So that's like, and Scribe also, just not, in my time there, I've never had to deal with a disk being full because there's a log file or copying a file anywhere. It's just like, there is a team that worries about that, but they're a small focus team, and then for me, it's just magic. It's great.
So they build that reusable architectural tool set, and that's something that we're open sourcing in terms of drafts.
There's also culturally, like, you're responsible for your stuff. Like, you're responsible for your changes. If you break something and I have to then go clean it up, I'm going to talk to you about it. I'm not going to be happy about it.
You don't want that.
Yeah, nobody wants that. Nobody wants to talk to me at all. Ideally, if they can avoid it. I just feel like I'm harping on this up here, but, like, seriously, the application developer has this huge amount of responsibility, both for the code that they are writing themselves. Obviously, they want to write good code so they can get through it, but they want to ship something. Shipping is a feature, and we believe in that.
But like they also have a responsibility to the other engineers that they're working with who are going to use their code or interact with them. One cool thing about being such an agile kind of small team, always as small as we possibly can be to get as much as we can, is that you know who built this code. Like, you know why it was built the way it was built, and you understand like why it might have shortcomings or what they are. And ultimately, you're on the hook for your code standing that same scrutiny, that same social scrutiny.
So my first question was, I think Mike said something about data-driven schemas. So I assume that means that you can find that that's stored in MySQL.
Yeah.
So in that case, how do you deal with indexes? If like, you know, if it's not, there's no DBA or anything, like you're just adding additional columns or blob or using blobs, how do you index that to the query you pass? That's my first question.
Sure. So this is what I was kind of alluding to, which it causes operational issues, which those data-driven schemas are fairly simple, and it basically usually means you can only fetch your data in one direction. So, for example, key-value pairs, where you can only fetch it by the key. So you've got a basic ID, you can fetch it, or associations between objects where you can only, you know, fetch it by one side of the association. So you can't do, you know, easily more complicated queries that are going to be very performant on that. So that's the answer. That's part of the trade-off, is you have to do some more data management at the application layer. One of the things we're looking at is ways to expand that data storage so you can effectively, at the application layer, kind of provide more context, more information, think of it like query hints, in order to allow us to store that data so that we can access, you know, keep the more frequently accessed parts of it hot, you know, both on the server and in Memcache. Second question, go for it.
Yeah, so your MySQL replication kind of dirty cache hack that you described it that you do from West Coast to East Coast. How is that going to work? Like if you ever have a data center like in Europe or Asia, like do you plan to cross the ocean with that hack, or
we're going to ship DVDs to Europe 3 weeks later, load up the site. So it doesn't really work very well for many more data centers. So it's one of the kind of, like, this is the other thing. It's like, I presented all this stuff, like, it's done and it's all, you know, light and good. And it's really worked well for us to scale, and I think will kind of work well for us in the future. But there are a number of very difficult unsolved problems at Facebook. The multi-data center beyond two is one of them because of how interconnected the data is. So there's a small set of people off looking at this now in terms of different ways to do better replication of the data, maybe more asynchronously to allow us to have it across multiple data centers. All the stuff you're asking about in terms of data-driven schemas, replacing Memcache with, you know, write-through caches that have that store the data closer to the way we access it. There are a number of things that are like just starting now that are really, really interesting deep systems problems that we don't totally know the answer to. And that's part of why it's fun. Like if all the answers were there and we're just kind of turning the crank, then all of these smart guys would not want to come work, you know, every day. So, you know, lots of problems left for you to solve.
I was just going to throw in, that's one of the problems I'm ramping up on right now. I wish this was like 4 weeks later and I could tell you more. But basically, it's a known problem. This is one of the things that we have to solve before we can go to more than two data centers. And we know that, and we're working on it. And
he's been there 6 weeks, so it's awesome.
And it's a hugely interesting problem.
Give the man a break, jeez.
Yeah. Anyone else had their hand up for quite a while? Over here.
How do you pick your battles in terms of addressing performance problems? And specifically, do you go for like saving money on operations, or do you go for faster, better user experience, and you're happy to throw more money at it?
Yeah, I think it'd be fair to say. Do you want to jump in on this?
I'm going to.
Yeah, go for it.
We have a lot of data. We can make decisions in a really data-driven way. Like, we do a really good job of collecting data. I've been there 6 weeks, and I haven't even really scratched the surface of the amount of data that we have that we can look through. So really, we can make good decisions. We have a really good A/B testing framework, and we can look at a lot of different things, how the users behave on the site, sort of how much interaction they have, all those sorts of things, and we can make good decisions based on, I mean, we are concerned about cost, but it really, you know, one of the things that I really like about or I'll hold it closer. One of the things that I really like about Facebook is they
look far into the future. When I hear Mark talk, Mark Zuckerberg, he really thinks about what's the best long-term thing to do. We're not optimizing necessarily for how much cash can we make next quarter or how much money can we save this year. It's really about let's make the best user experience, and by doing the right thing, good things will happen. And as you can see with that graph that we showed at the beginning, they really do happen.
Dreams come true.
Yeah, way up in the back.
So, what's the ratio of the number of machines running Memcache versus MySQL?
I don't think I can actually tell you that ratio.
That's why I asked that question.
Yeah.
Awesome question. Next question. In the orange over there?
Yeah, so one of the challenges that I found with scaling services that I built for my company is knowing where specifically the scaling problem bottleneck lies, so you know that you have high load. Can you just describe what your process is, especially before you had all these great monitoring solutions, to figure out exactly where the bottleneck was and what you needed to do to address it?
I want to tell a quick story. I'll answer your question. I want to tell a story real quickly. We had an intern 2 years ago, 2 summers ago. It was awesome. And all he started doing, just for fun, he finished his internship project in 2 weeks because he was just wicked smart. And he just started taking machines down in production. Didn't really tell anyone he was going to do that. He just started knocking machines down to see where stuff broke. And then he'd bring the machine back up really quickly. And then he'd go fix the leak. We call that Ben testing now, in honor of him. The good news about growing this way is that for the most part, we don't have to guess. We know exactly where the bottlenecks are at any given time because something is almost always hot. And by the time we deal on whatever's hot and get that fixed, two other things have become hot. It's a game of whack-a-mole, right? There's always another one jumping up somewhere. So we actually haven't had a problem finding where the bottlenecks are thus far. And I think it's a good thing and a bad thing, obviously.
Yeah. So, I had another question. This is kind of non-technical, but you have the news feed and you have the live feed. Can you guys elaborate a little bit? Can you elaborate a little bit on what the uptake has been with that, and also why you have it, and what the user experience points are?
Okay.
I'm not meaning to be antagonistic. I'm really not.
Yeah, we were talking about this in the cab. So we were looking at the way we have all this data that we could possibly show you on the homepage, and we've kind of swung back and forth in different directions. So when I first started, the news feed was maybe 50 stories a day, heavily aggregated. Some connection, what we would call connection stories, your RSVPing to an event, some content stories, someone posted a photo. We decided to make a move towards real time, and we did that back in March, and so everything became this new content creation stories only. Connections got relegated to highlights.
Okay.
No one really liked highlights. Highlights, they looked like ads, they pushed events down on the page, people were forgetting people's birthdays, and that's a really bad user experience in real life. So it's actually amazing. With the experimentation frameworks we talk about, we actually did remove highlights for some subset of users and saw what happened to their activities, and birthday wall posts were up some absurd amount. So basically, though, what we decided is that kind of two things. There's one that it's just hard to build newsfeed. We have to support really these two modalities. One is that I want to see everything interesting that's gone on in my network over the past week or so. And I also want to see what's happening right now. And so, actually, the biggest challenge, we actually had kind of mocks of this new homepage up and running back in June, and the biggest problems we found were, how do we expose this switching UI? How can we get people into using both of these modalities? Because in this room, there's probably going to be a lot of power users, and you're going to spend your time on live feed and see everything as it comes through. But there's also a lot of users who are going to sign on to the site once a day, yeah. And we want to be able to show them the best stuff.
So it's kind of like a Twitter versus Google News distinction, right? It's relevant versus current, almost?
We just do them both.
I see, yeah.
Yeah. I'd say they were copying us.
Sure, okay.
Did that answer your question, by the way?
Yeah,
so newsfeed is basically the best stuff of the last 24 hours, and it can include content from friends of friends. And then live feed is everything as it happens in chronological order.
I see. Okay, sure.
So this isn't so much a technical question, but you guys are obviously into open source, both open sourcing your stuff and contributing back to stuff. From a business standpoint, why? Like, why are you doing it? Why not just keep it all?
There's really two parts of it. So one part is really obvious leverage. So if you actually get a piece of open source software and get a thriving community around it, this is a community of people who are going to maintain, use, modify, improve, support this piece of software. And it's now, let's say that it's Thrift or RPC mechanism, it's now something that I'm not having to support, you know, for the next 10 years. For any of you who've worked in maybe a big corporation before, like the worst software on the planet is a thing that someone wrote 15 years ago that some corporation is dependent on, that like no one knows how it works and then no one wants to touch it. And it's like, you know, it's just terrible software. And so I think the infrastructure software for us is a way to get leverage and support for these sorts of things. And realizing that we build a lot of really cool stuff, but I don't think our RPC mechanism is the thing that's going to make us win in our market. Like, I think it's the fact that we have really smart engineers that can move really fast and build products faster than anyone else. And that's our long-term sustainable advantage. And then the second is not really business, but more philosophical, which is Facebook was built on open source and probably could not have started without, you know, a free database and a free caching server and a free web server. And so just conceptually, it's great for us to give away the architecture and the infrastructure so that the next crop of awesome technology startups can go off there and explore new ideas and create great innovation in the ecosystem.
Have you actually seen people, like, for the stuff you've open sourced, have you seen people come in and do a lot of contribution?
Oh, yeah. Like, we are no longer the primary contributors to Thrift. I talk to people every week that are using Cassandra, major websites. Some of these things, we use very friendly licenses. So our licenses, you know, we don't even know when everyone uses it. So, you know, it's hard to tell for sure, but there are a lot of people using it and a lot of people contributing in a lot of different ways. The one thing I'll say about open source is everyone seems to always think it's about the source code when really it's about the community. I've seen, and we've made this mistake before too, it's like, here's a bunch of source code, and like just the community is supposed to magically pop up around it. Or really the hard part is actually getting a set of people who are spending time passionately kind of changing and modifying that code. We've been very successful with Thrift and a few others and actually building that thriving open source ecosystem. And it's something we're committed all the way up, you know, to Mark Zuckerberg is committed to do this too, that all our major pieces of infrastructure, kind of shared infrastructure, we will open source over time, which is something different than most big companies. Yeah, who, see.
How do you manage the quality that you get back?
What's that?
How do you manage the quality of what you get back?
Well, that's a good question. I actually think many open source projects do a better job of managing quality than many commercial entities. If you're building every open source project works a little bit differently, but most of them are built on the concept of peer review of some form, that you have people who have demonstrated good judgment and authority at a technical level on the project, and those are the gatekeepers to allow you to commit or commit to a stable branch. And so ultimately, just like you do in an organization, is you have a set of trusted technical people who are making decisions on the ground, and they're the ones kind of gatekeeping the code. And that's what I mean by thriving, stable, you know, open source community project. If you have something like Apache or something like Firefox, you know, these things are all self-sustaining open source communities that in many ways, I think, build software that rivals many commercial offerings in quality. Yeah?
For your mobile application, is that a push model or a pull model?
Sure. So mobile is many, many separate applications all working together. Essentially, we have the dumbass HTML site or WAP site, whatever you want to call it, called m.facebook.com. We have this is a pretty brief. We have a JavaScript-enabled site for the higher-end browsers called touch.facebook.com, also X or iPhone, different devices for it. But what I imagine you're mostly talking about is the application space, Facebook for iPhone, Facebook for Android, Facebook for Palm, for yada, 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 right? So what you're asking is, are these phones working on the push or the pull molecule? Do they pull or are they sent notifications? So right now they pull, but we are working on rolling out some stuff very soon in which we are going to be doing push notifications, which is something that a lot of phones are looking at supporting right now, and someone's done a really good job. So we're moving towards push.
So the pushing, is that an on or existing connection, or how do you actually address the mobile?
I'm sorry. What do you mean? There's different protocols for different providers. They all have their different idiosyncrasies of their you know, handshake. But what are you specifically asking?
Okay. The question I have is that if mobile doesn't have connection connected to the server already, how does the server actually address mobile and push the content down?
That's mostly for some of these the big providers. That's like what the server that's between their server and them. essentially, right? So most of the time for us.
I was going to ask, what's kind of the ratio of people working on back-end things like scalability versus people working on front-end applications? And also, I imagine this is more of a, like, kind of the structural development cycle of front-end applications. Is it, you know, how does it compare to kind of the Google APM, people who worked at Microsoft APM did? Like, I'm just kind of curious how it's different than Facebook.
The question was ratio of kind of infrastructure to product, and then I brought a question about how product management works compared to Google, Microsoft, and others. I worked at neither Google nor Microsoft, so I'll let our other experts answer that part of the question. In terms of ratios, I'd say this isn't an exact ratio, but if I think broadly across the organization, it's probably, you know, around one quarter working on tools, one quarter working on monetization of some form, one quarter working on products, one quarter working on infrastructure. That's a pretty rough breakdown, because a lot of the product groups end up building infrastructure for themselves. So, for example, Multifeed, which I think is a piece of infrastructure, isn't in the infrastructure group. It's in the team that built the front end. And this is why I was talking about earlier our philosophy of services is, like, definitely believe in vertically integrated teams that know how to solve their customer's problem. The ads team that Greg works with, you know, has built an ad serving platform that serves, you know, billions of impressions a day, using a lot of the other pieces of our technology, but they have done it. Does one of you guys want to address the APM question?
I worked at Microsoft for a couple years. I worked in the Visio group, for those wondering. And I think one of the biggest differences between the two, and I was talking about this in the lobby a little earlier, is kind of the role definitions aren't that strictly structured. Just like he's had a tough time defining who's working on infrastructure versus product, because we don't make a strong distinction there.
Yep.
We also don't make a strong distinction between, like, PMs must do X, Y, or Z, and developers must do these kind of things. Like, ultimately, we're all as a team working together towards a common goal. We do have PMs. On some teams, those are kind of more like what you would think of as PMs from, like, a Microsoft standpoint, where, you know, they're trying to gather requirements and understand the customer and, like, working with the engineer on that. It's never, ever, ever, ever here spec, like, implement code. Like, it's never that. It's never that thing. So even though the role is somewhat similar in terms of what they're interfacing with, like, it's more of a team effort in terms of what the final product looks like. But different teams use PMs differently. There's also, so for example, I work on the messaging team in the inbox. You can imagine there's all these kind of corner cases where it's like, hey, you got a message that had a photo attachment, but then I can't see that photo attachment because of privacy that someone set later on. Like, what's the case there? So there's a ton of kind of product surface area that the PM handles, and, like, I don't have to worry about that because I know he's got a handle on that. Different projects, some PMs are really doing much more project management. Some PMs are really directing the product pretty strongly, and the engineers are totally bought into their decisions and trust them completely. So we really try not to draw really strong distinctions or lines between roles, between teams, between managers, between groups. Like, the more we can just be fluid and agile, the happier we are as a team.
I think PMs sort of take that glue role, right? Some PMs actually work on many, many different projects. I've worked with some fine PMs I've invited here at Microsoft, and they did, you know, one specific thing, but oftentimes they will sort of, because a lot of these product decisions, energy, motivation, thoughts about it are driven from the engineers themselves who decide to build this project or decide, hey, what if we did this? Or, the PMs sort of have to a lot of times fill that gap and just make sure the whole thing, you know, runs. And sometimes they do one thing and sometimes they do 100 different things, or let's say, I don't know, five or six.
I have a follow-up question, if you don't mind, really quick, so you guys can address while you're talking about it.
Yeah.
So, you guys, it sounds like you've painted this picture for us, right? You know, and we're all going to come away with some picture, but it sounds like you guys in particular have put a lot of effort into building a nice, layered, partitioned, scalable, optimized back-end, and, correct me if I'm wrong, you have a big ball of business logic written in PHP that somebody else is worrying about. Is that a wrong picture? I worry about the whole cultural.
We're worried about that too.
A lot of the people here actually work on all of that stuff. So this isn't like the infrastructure team.
Okay.
So
that's kind of my question, right? Is some companies that I've worked at in the area that aren't Microsoft or Google have evolved sort of a big surly labor union of PHP or whatever programmers who are kind of like second-class citizens, and it causes all these calibration problems, and, you know, it's a problem that I was hoping that you guys have avoided.
So let me try and address this, because I was going to add something, and I'll let you jump in too. So So one thing that I think is really important that about our engineering culture that both Boz and Fetterman just touched on a bit, I think we are defining our culture by not trying to overly define what roles individuals play. And that the reason we believe in that is, you know, when I think of, I want you all to think about some project you were on or some product you used that was exceptional. Think about something that just worked really well. And one defining characteristic of that usually is that you can't have those kind of exceptional products, technology, or projects without people who are exceptional. And people who are really entrepreneurial and exceptional, whether it be on technology or products, don't tend to like to be boxed into, like, this is what a manager does, you know, do the following six things, and you must have X number of reports, and you can only work on projects like Y. We actually try the reverse, which is like, we've got this person who's amazing, who has the following sets of skills. When they're working on that, they're unbelievable. So let's see if we can structure an environment where that set of skills is applied towards something that's really useful for the organization, and we're structured with all the right sets of people that together kind of talk about sharp-pointing individuals and a well-rounded organization, that set of people together can actually accomplish something really, really well. So that means that each project is actually very different at Facebook, because the engineering manager, the tech lead, the PM may be very different personalities. So you figure out how to kind of structure those projects around it. I think it's equally important, there are not PHP programmers at Facebook. There's no one who walks around and says, I'm a PHP programmer. You say, I'm a Facebook engineer. And this is part of also our ethos, is that you should be able to do anything. If you've been working on the Linux kernel for the last 15 years, and I need you to look at a CSS bug, like you should be willing to say, all right, well, I don't know it, so it's going to take me a little bit, but I'll check it out. And that's generally true for all the people in the infrastructure, in the organization. This also means that, like, there isn't this class of people that say, like, well, I don't touch the infrastructure, I just write PHP code. Like, they will often, like, a lot of the pieces of infrastructure actually came out of this group, because they're like, yeah, this stuff isn't efficient in PHP, so I'm going to, like, go build an Erlang chat server, or go build a crazy multi-view thing in C++. So I think the general ethos there is programmer athletes rather than, you know, someone who, like, I only do this one thing. We do have specialists in certain areas, but I think in general the ethos is, you know, to allow people to do it. So, you know, there is a big ball of business logic, but I think it's not like one, you know, cabal of second-class programmers work on that. There's a Facebook engineer.
But how do you manage this from the top and from the bottom?
What's crazy about it?
It is a little crazy.
Yeah, it is.
delusion. That's how I manage it. Complete and utter delusion.
One of my favorite surprising things about, so I work on a platform team, so I can't talk about how all these teams operate, but about our team. If my manager, like, we have a roadmap, we sort of drop, our roadmaps are never more than like a couple months, but they might be like, hey, let's brainstorm. There's like 25 awesome things that would be really cool if we could accomplish them. And there's 10 or 8 engineers, and so there's a lot of just, like, my manager, he just asked me, like, so, you know, what do you want to work on? Like, it's basically every week or quarter, it's just like, what do you want to work on? It's very self-directed, which is what I kind of like. I mean, not self-directed, like, go off and build some silly thing, although we do that too, but, like, you know, there's more hard problems to solve than we have people to solve, and so there's a lot of, like, if you've got a choice of 3 hard projects, we'd rather have you working on the one that you want to work on.
Everyone really has, like, a lot of ownership and buy-in into what we're doing. Like, people, you don't work at Facebook because you're like, hey, it's like a pretty decent job. Like, I love Palo Alto. You do it because it's Facebook. You believe in what we're doing. You're excited about it. Like, you have passion for it. And, like, the best software is built by passionate developers. And all we're really trying to do is, from a management standpoint, and I'm somewhere in the middle, like, I now manage a small team. It's like, I just want to get everyone who is working with me aligned and headed, like, pointed the same direction, and then just, like, let them go and see what they build. And so, as much as possible, in our group, and I talked about this again earlier, it's all coming back to me, when you distribute decision-making, like we've tried to do, and really distribute decision-making out to the people who have the most information, who are most able to make the decision, is the person who's working on the software, they're going to have the best call. It's absolutely the wrong thing for me as a manager to come in and be like, oh, nope, you're doing it this way, because, like, I know best, and, like, I'm a big and important guy. Quite the opposite. Like, I see, as a manager, I see my role as, like, a service organization. Like, my job is to, like, keep everyone on my team, like, unblocked, happy, productive, and share with them the vision that anytime I have a piece of information that I've talked to Zuck or I've heard from Shrep or, like, hey, I was in this meeting and we were talking about this thing, and make sure that we all have a really open and transparent dialogue about all the different vision discussions that are happening and, like, where we're going, and getting people really excited about that. If they're not excited about the vision that we're on, that's fine. Like, we have enough stuff going on that's so awesome. Like, we have just the list of things that we
don't have the time to build is embarrassing. Like, we have such cool stuff just lying in the wings because we don't have enough people that it's really, we haven't yet come across an engineer who we couldn't find something they were excited about that was what in line with the way we were all going.
Also, want to jump quick, we don't have architects. We don't have the Uber programmer who says, all right, like, you know, beta programmers, you figure out how to do this, and the betas say, all right, gamma programmers, like, here's what you're going to do, and the gammas tell the janitor, you know, whatever that he needs to do, right? So it's not like it's a top-down vision. We're in sync together most of the time, sometimes we're not, and we figure things out as we go, and it's sort of, we just, there's a lot of practice that you need to make this sort of thing work, and we're actually, you know, pretty good at it. So it's not top down in that same way, where in order to accomplish this at this date, we will have to have done exactly this. We don't know what it's going to take. You know, sometimes you don't know what's going to be done, but it's really hard to map out anything, as Luke said, in great detail, and to say if we did exactly this, then we've done exactly what we're supposed to do months before we do. This guy.
With all this, then, how big of a concern is burnout is, and what's the efficiency rate of
Very generous vacation policy. No, we do have great benefits, great vacation policy. We have a really fun culture. So to counter your burnout story, let me tell you about hackathons. Hackathons are like all-night coding sessions that we literally, so like, regular work week, like next week is going to be a regular work week. I will work 5 days in the office, I'll be there, normal times, whatever, my usual schedule. But for no other reason than my excitement, I will work from 6 p.m. until the following morning at 8 a.m. on something. I don't know what it's going to be yet. I haven't decided. But I'm going to go do that. And then I'm going to work a normal work day after. Like, I've been at the company for 4 years. If I'm not burned out, you're building all the stuff that I've built, like, nobody's going to... There's an excitement. I can't describe it to you. I'm just trying to express it through my actions and my rapid gesturing. So I'm not saying burnout's never a problem. We do really encourage people to take advantage of our benefits, take advantage of the fact that we have, like, free food, that we have, you know, laundry things that can hopefully make some things easier in your life. We have a great vacation policy. We really, like, absolutely encourage people to go out and kind of explore and innovate and have their own ideas that they can take ownership of and, like, and really do that kind of stuff. And I think that is a really big tool in combating it. But the other half of it is, like, you know, when I came from Microsoft, and I love my job at Microsoft, and I don't want to bet it, but I really loved it. When I came from Microsoft to Facebook, I went from working, like, 6 hours a day to working a lot more than that. Not because I had deadlines, not because I had a boss yelling at me, not because of any other reason than what I was working on was awesome. Just awesome. And that makes a big difference when it comes to fighting burnout.
Also, you get burned out when stuff sucks, right? Or you can't, there's something irreconcilable that you can't move forward on, right? So yeah. People change projects, you know, all the time as they, you know, get what they want out of this project, they build something, you know, now they have this new idea and they want to go up and do something else, you know, so you're not pigeonholed into doing one thing. You're not a database engineer. You're not a PHP engineer. You're not an events engineer or whatever. So that probably helps too.
I mean, playing on to that, I'm like, I just joined the databases team.
You're 6 weeks, man.
I know. I just joined the databases team, but, like, to address a few of the points we just talked about, like, I still have some PHP code that I'm working on, and it doesn't feel like that's, like, a lesser thing to do. I almost joined the growth team, which would have been, like, a lot of front-end PHP stuff, and I was really interested in that. It's just, you know, I had to make a choice between two really good teams, and I chose one of them. So, and that's a really great thing, you know. I mean, I got there, and I was interested in too many things, you know. And... like, maybe you can tell I'm sitting up here smiling like an idiot because everything they say sounds so true, and I've only been there for 6 weeks, but I'm so excited about it, and there's so many opportunities in front of me, and I just, it's dreams come true.
Follow your dreams.
Yes. Jeez. Who's...
So we've talked about quality, and we've talked about roles. So I'm wondering how you guys test for stuff, especially for multiple browsers, for the large distribution that you guys have. How, like, if it's a very design thing, or a Microsoft thing, where there's, you know, testers over here that do the monthly thing, and you guys are having coffee today.
So no, there's at Microsoft, in my group, there was maybe like 1 to 1.5 testers per engineer, essentially. And you had a group of people, and a process built around testing. And by the way, I was working on the CLR in .NET in a a deployed server-side project that had to be perfect, and we got it out the first time, right? So it really is kind of up to the group as far as how individual pieces get tested. A lot of times, you know, if you're front-end enough, test is, does this work on all these different browsers, you know? Like, does it work on Firefox? Yes. Does it work on Safari? Yes. You know, make sure to check out E6, you know, this sort of thing. Like, that happens on the browser level, right? So shake your fist, whatever. But if you're running a real-time service, you know, a big database service, you have to put up through some load testing and you know, see if you get the fall over and that sort of thing. I don't know if we have whole release testing thing that we've done.
So, I mean, I think the basic model is extreme continuous integration. And so, you know, people alluded to this before, but the team has built a lot of tools that make it very easy to very rapidly not just push code to all the production servers, but actually enable features on different user bases. So, you know, your typical cycle is, I've got something new, I get it through a code review, which is the first level of quality check. I've certainly done some testing on it myself. Then I may turn it on to dev, which is only available for, you know, Facebook to check out there. Then I may turn it on in production for Facebook employees when they're in the office. And so you kind of get to do some quality testing there. Then you could, depending on, you know, how worried you are about the feature, you may kind of incrementally roll it out to different sections of the user around the user base around the world at, you know, whatever increment you want, 0.1%, 1%. And you can turn it off in seconds if something goes really, really wrong. So I think that the way to think about quality is a very continuous integration and feedback cycle. We're trying to continuously get information. We're always building off of trunk. So there's these really, really long branches that you have to merge back in. That's, I'd say, the best. The thing that's a little crazy is we do not have a QA department. So that actually, just like Boz talked about in terms of, the reason I say culture, because I think culture really affects everything, is a real sense of ownership from start to finish. I help define the product. I write the code for it. I push it onto the live servers, and I support it when it's up there. And when you have someone who owns the product from beginning to end, that's what an entrepreneur does when I'm the only person starting a company. And that's why that product is great, because you put your own passion into it. And if you're going to get the call on Sunday at 8 a.m. from me if something's down, you're going to spend the time to make sure the thing's bulletproof so it's not going to have issues or has graceful failover or ungraceful failure recovery if there's an issue. And so I think, again, it's about, you kind of ask, how do you manage this whole thing? It starts with, like, this doesn't work with mediocre programmers. Like, it starts with hiring really, really only people who can deal with this kind of chaos and are very good at their game. And then you give them lots of control and passion and ability to operate and let them make really good decisions. So I think that is kind of the model of how we work, and the question is, how long can we do it? And, you know, I don't know, but it's worked really, really well for us so far. Out of time, but given the ixnay.
So, no, I just wanted to let you guys know that we can continue this up at the Rev Bar. They're all going to head up there. So, if you guys want to ask questions, there's appetizers and beer and wine and soda. If you guys want to head up there and join us,
thanks, everyone.
Yeah, thank you.